Welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Thank you for spending time with us today. Coming up in just a bit, a report from Harvest Public Media on the potential use of cotton seeds. At one time thought to be toxic, they may end up being a great source of protein. Plus, the story of people who grew up with a force of nature that's become almost mythic in the American West, and that's the Santa Ana winds. We begin Main Street today by taking a closer look at a really historic moment for North Dakota's judiciary. Justice Lisa Fair McEvers has been elected as the state's first female Chief Justice, a role that shapes everything from court administration to the direction of major legal questions in North Dakota. At the same time, long-serving Justice Daniel Crothers has announced he'll retire in February, opening a rare seat on the state's highest court. To help us understand what all of this means, we're pleased to be joined again by Mary Stoyer. She's a reporter for the North Dakota Monitor based in Bismarck, and she's been covering the courts, the supermajority rule, we'll talk more about that, and the shifting dynamics inside the judicial system for quite some time. Mary, welcome back to Main Street.
Hello, thank you for having me.
We are pleased that you are with us again. And now, Mary, that the vote is decided, give us a quick overview of why this is such a pivotal moment for the North Dakota Supreme Court, especially with Lisa Fair McEvers becoming the first female Chief Justice in the state's history. What's changing?
Yeah, well, as you said, she's the first female Chief Justice and the fourth woman to serve on the Supreme Court in North Dakota state history. And the Chief Justice doesn't have any more voting power than the rest of the court, but they do have a hand in, deciding some of the court's priorities. They're a source of support for the district court judges, and they're sort of the face of the court with the public and then the other two branches of government.
Why should North Dakotans, everyday North Dakotans, care about the leadership transition at the top of the judiciary in the state?
I think not a lot of North Dakotans probably know who's sitting on the state Supreme Court, but understanding the individual at the top and their leadership style and where they come from, I think is one indicator, maybe not the sole indicator, but an important indicator of what kind of court you have and what sort of issues that are facing the court and maybe how the court is going to tackle those problems. So
walk us through how this selection unfolded, Mary, since it's not a public election. Who actually voted? And what does it mean that McEvers got an overwhelming 83% of the vote total?
So North Dakota does it different from any other state. It's pretty interesting. The Chief Justice is selected by a vote of the 54 district court judges and then the justices on the court. So it's a total of 59 people can vote. And so what they did is when Chief Justice Jensen announced he was planning to retire at the end of the year, they sent ballots out to all of the judges and justices who could vote. And then they recently held a public counting where they opened the ballots and counted them and then announced Justice Fair McEvers as the winner. And then, like you said, she got a significant percentage of the votes. And I think that could either signal, the judiciary sees her as a good leader, maybe they aligned more with her priorities, although her and Justice Tufte did have a lot of the same priorities that they shared. But then also, it could also be kind of a seniority thing. When I talked to some of the justices, it sounded like the Chief Justice is often one of the senior most justice is on the court, and Justice Fair McEvers has served for a little bit longer than Justice Tufte.
Talk to us a little bit about Justice Tufte. What might he have brought to the court as a leader that may have been different? He kind of has an unusual career path.
Yeah, so he started as a software engineer and then decided that he wanted to go to law school. After that, I believe he worked in patent law, working for like technology companies. And so when I talked to him about his decision to become a justice and then seek the role as Chief Justice, he said he was really passionate about helping the court modernize and tackle some of its like technology growing pains in a responsible way. He also particularly mentioned AI So he's head of an AI task force within the judicial system that's kind of looking at, can they use AI to automate some of the more like mundane and time-consuming tasks for some of the court's administration. So I think even though he wasn't chief, he's still going to be pursuing those things, but he seemed very excited about that.
I was surprised in an early interview that I had with Chief Justice Jensen about his willingness to consider AI, and perhaps it was because of Judge Tufte's influence, but certainly that will make a difference in North Dakota Supreme Court, as it is making a difference in courts across the country. All right, talked about increasing resources for district courts and phasing out judicial referee positions, and we're talking now about North Dakota's new first female Supreme Court Chief Justice, Lisa Fair McEvers. What's behind her priorities, do you think, and how big of a structural change, if any, might North Dakotans notice in lower courts?
A lot of her priorities, I think she shares with Chief Justice Jensen and probably her other colleagues on the court. I think they all sort of want to support district court judges as best they can. But when I talked to Justice McEvers, she said one of the things she's interested in doing is phasing out judicial referees. And judicial referees, I didn't know, I hadn't heard of them at the time I was talking to her, but she said they're sort of a niche position where you have attorneys who are called on to serve as judges in specific situations. So she mentioned some scenarios where they might work is like small claims court, juvenile court, or traffic court. And so they're not judges, but they sort of serve in that role. And it seems like the idea is that they help district court judges when they have a big workload and need someone else to sort of do some stuff on the side. But Justice McEvers kind of said, well, people have a constitutional right to have their cases heard in front of a district court judge. And so we don't really want to have like different levels of judges. And there are actually only 5 judicial referees left in the state. So she said she doesn't want to fire anyone, but if given the opportunity, she would support sort of phasing those jobs out. And then she said she would support kind of using the money to create more judgeships. And so the idea, she kind of put it, there's been a push to unify the courts since the 90s, when there used to be like county courts and the state court system. And so she put that in terms of like, eventually getting rid of judicial referees would create a more unified system.
Mary, you mentioned earlier, of course, that Chief Justice McEvers, as Chief Justice Jensen, only has one vote on the Supreme Court equal to the other justices. But there's also this supermajority rule, supermajority law the court has to decide appeals. And in the case that you and I have talked about before, it made a big difference in the abortion decision last month. Have you reflected any more about that? Learned anything more about how unique North Dakota and maybe Nebraska are with the only states of that kind of rule? And did you talk about that with incoming Chief Justice McEvers?
Yeah, so that rule is in the state constitution. And we're one of 2 states that requires when the Supreme Court is looking at the constitutionality of a law, in order to overturn it, they need 4 or 5 justices to find the law unconstitutional. I didn't ask Justice McEvers about it. I should have. I wonder if any of the justices on the court would be willing to talk about it candidly, because I would love to know their opinion about it, but it's sometimes hard to get the justices to disclose what they're really thinking.
That might be a question all of us can ask here in future days. Enjoying my conversation with Mary Storier. She's a reporter for the North Dakota Monitor based in Bismarck, and she covers the courts for the North Dakota Monitor. We've been talking about the first ever female Chief Justice now being elected for North Dakota's Supreme Court. We also have an upcoming vacancy on the Supreme Court. Mary, I would like to talk about that for just a little bit. Justice Crothers has announced his retirement. What's the process now? How long will he serve? And how does it work for North Dakota to now replace him?
I believe he announced that he was planning to retire in February. So what happens when there's a vacancy on the court, but the justice still has time left in their term, is that the governor appoints someone to fill the position. So they have a judicial nominating committee that is now accepting nominations. So anyone who is eligible, who wants to be a Supreme Court justice, can apply. And I think the application window closes next week. And after that, the nominating committee will meet and look through the pool of applicants. And then I think they can pick 2 to 7 to officially recommend to the governor. And then the governor can say, yes, I want this person. Or they can say, go back and give me more names. Or he can refer it to an election. And I should have said earlier, typically in North Dakota, when someone's term as justice ends, there's an election. But again, like if it's in the middle of their term, then there's an appointment process.
Mary, let me ask you this question. When we hear about the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, certainly it is bending to be either more progressive or perhaps more conservative at any time in history. Do you get any idea whether North Dakota's Supreme Court is bending one way or the other, or would you classify it, from everything that you know, as a relatively moderate court?
That's really hard to say. When you look at the abortion decision that came out recently, you could analyze that in terms of like, okay, we had this faction of two justices who made the more conservative decision, and then you had the three that made the less conservative decision. Because a lot of their decisions aren't on explicitly political issues, sometimes it's hard to know, like, is this person a reliably conservative vote or not? To me, just looking at the people on the court, it seems like they're all sort of, you know, typical North Dakota. Like the court itself, I don't think there's anyone who stands out as like liberal, but in some of the ways the court falls on certain issues, it seems like there's kind of a more progressive side and a less progressive side. But again, I think like a lot of times, even when you hear the U.S. Supreme Court talking about these things, they're like, oh, we're not political. I think Justice Amy Coney Barrett once said like, oh, we're not red or blue, we all wear black. But it's funny because, you know, if you ask the average member of the public, they're like, no, we don't believe you. Like, this is a very polarized court. So I don't know. To be fair to the state Supreme Court, I haven't watched them closely enough to say for sure. But I think they, again, going back to the abortion decision, I do think that's kind of telling.
When will Justice McEvers become the Chief Justice?
January 1st is her first day.
So what can listeners now follow in your reporting, Mary, about your continuing coverage of the courts? Specifically, are there any cases that are coming before the court that really have your attention?
Yeah, so I'm really excited about next week. There's part of the Greenpeace case was appealed to the state Supreme Court. And it's sort of this, there are so many moving parts of that case, but it's this very niche part of it where the plaintiffs, Energy Transfer, the developers of the Dakota Access Pipeline, wanted the district court judge to tell Greenpeace International, one of the Greenpeace organizations that's based in the Netherlands, they're one of three defendants in the case. They wanted them to stop suing Energy Transfer in the Netherlands. So they asked the district court to order that, and he was like, no, I'm not going to do that. They appealed that to the state Supreme Court, and they're hearing oral arguments on that next Friday in person. And I'm really interested in that because I'm interested in seeing the case go before a new set of people because it is such a strange and unique case, and it's been going on for so long that I'm really interested. I don't know if the justices will let on at all what they think of the case, but I'm interested to see what kind of questions they ask.
So are they asking for a decision to be overturned?
Yes, yeah, so they are asking for the district court's decision not to interfere in the overseas lawsuit to be overturned.
This certainly is a historic moment for the North Dakota Supreme Court. We've been pleased to be joined by Mary Stoyer. She's a reporter for the North Dakota Monitor in Bismarck, and you can follow her ongoing coverage of the courts and North Dakota public affairs at northdakotamonitor.com. Mary, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation in partnership with Strengthen ND, announcing the 2025 Bush Prize North Dakota honorees, TNT Kids Fitness, and Hip Hop and Hope. More at strengthenND.com.
A mushrooming industry serves the dead. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The Trump administration announced last week that it would take additional water from Northern California and send it south to farms and communities in the San Joaquin Valley, which drew strong criticism from Governor Gavin Newsom's office.
The Bureau of Reclamation updated its plan for the Central Valley Project, which is a massive, federally operated 400-mile system of dams, reservoirs, and canals that provide water to irrigate about one-third of the state's agriculture.
California's State Water Project also moves water south. Both the state and the feds take water from the Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta, a critical habitat for wildlife and fish like salmon and Delta smelt.
Back in 2009, NOAA Fisheries issued a report concluding that the long-term operations of both systems jeopardized salmon, sturgeon, and even orcas that depend on the salmon for food.
The Trump administration views that wildlife protection as lopsided. In January, after destructive fires in the Los Angeles area, the president issued an order titled, Putting People Over Fish.
State officials say taking more water from the Delta and putting it in federal canals and reservoirs will significantly harm fish and the ecosystem, and the state might need to cut allocations to cities and farms to protect it.
If you're in the market to buy a home, you probably want to find one that's safe from weather and climate change-related threats like floods, wildfires, or high winds.
That might be harder now because Zillow, one of the nation's largest real estate listing websites, has removed data about the risk of extreme events to a property.
According to a recent report, almost 45% of homes in the U.S. are at severe or extreme risk of at least one type of climate or weather event, such as flooding, winds, wildfires, heat, or hazardous air quality.
Zillow had used data from a risk modeling firm, First Street, to indicate a home's threat level. However, real estate agents said those scores hurt sales, and home sellers also objected, saying there was no way to challenge a rating.
The California Regional Multiple Listing Service, which has a large database of homes for sale in the country, pressured Zillow over concerns that risk assessments have been wrong about flooding in California.
A statement by Zillow said that it's committed to giving consumers helpful information and now provides hyperlinks to the First Street website.
This holiday season, many people will have Christmas trees decorated or flocked to appear golden. But what if you could have a tree already laden with the precious metal?
That tree exists, but you'd need a microscope to see the gold, and you'd have to travel to Lapland, Finland. Researchers there have found that spruce trees growing over gold deposits have gold nanoparticles in their needles.
The team, led by University of Oulu, says that if gold is in soil, it's likely in a liquid form. The trees were found to take up water infused with the gold through their roots and move it to their needles, where bacteria and microbes convert it back into solid, nano-sized particles.
Spruce aren't the only gold-digging trees. Several years ago, the precious metal was also found in the leaves of eucalyptus.
The process is called biomineralization, and it's where minerals like gold accumulate and solidify inside plant tissues as part of its defense mechanisms.
In the Finland study, only 4 of the 23 Norway spruce trees had the nanoparticles in their needles, which might indicate that the roots were tapping into different water sources. For that reason, the team says the trees could offer a bio-based and environmentally friendly way to explore for minerals. And finally, most of us want to live sustainably during our time on Earth, but how about after we die? Can we continue our environmental practices once we're gone?
The Loop Biotech Company has got you covered, literally, offering the world's first mushroom coffin. The caskets are biodegradable and made from fungi and upcycled hemp fibers. They fully decompose in just 45 days.
The coffins degrade because they rely on mycelium, the root network of mushrooms, nature's most powerful recycler. The company offers caskets that can be buried or sit on a forest floor. They also offer urns for ashes, including ones for pets called Loop Forever.
The Loop Biotech coffins are lined with moss and have jute handles so they can be carried to their final resting place.
That's a stark contrast to traditional coffins that take decades to degrade. Many caskets are treated with lacquers or varnishes and contain pillows and mattresses, and the entire box is sealed with metal hardware. Several studies have found these coffins pollute soils and groundwater.
Instead of those dead materials, the Loop Company says mushroom caskets enrich the soil by releasing nutrients from our loved ones into the ground, which allows new life to flourish.
Green burials are gaining popularity. One survey found that 84% of respondents said they would consider one.
So Loop Biotech asks, will you be waste or compost? They hope you'll choose the latter and make your final act your greatest.
That's it for this week in water. Tuesday, December 9th is Colorado Gives Day. Donate to H2O Radio and be entered to win a voucher on Southwest Airlines.
Still to come on Main Street, how a Texas scientist is trying to turn cottonseed into a global protein source, how North Dakota's winter becomes a hands-on STEM playground, and haunting memories of the Santa Ana winds that feel alive. Stay with us. Main Street continues on this Thursday. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and now we have a story about a seed most of us never think about, cottonseed. It's packed with protein, but it's also naturally toxic, making it inedible for people and most animals. One researcher has spent decades trying to change that, and if he succeeds, it could reshape the global cotton industry and even expand the world's food supply. Harvest Public Media's Michael Marks has the report.
If you look at a cotton seed, you'll see that it's covered in little black dots. And for 30 years, Kirti Rathore has been trying to make those dots disappear. It took him about a decade to publish his first study, but he kept going.
Most other scientists would have moved on to something else.
Rathore is a professor of soil and crop sciences at Texas A&M University. He specializes in genetic modification. The black dots are traces of gossypol, a toxin that makes cottonseed inedible for most animals.
And the plant actually needs this toxin because this toxin provides some resistance to insects and some diseases.
But reducing gossypol in seeds could revolutionize the cotton business. Farmers and processors could make more money off their crop by selling an inexpensive protein source for chicken, fish, and maybe even people.
And if you could utilize that protein directly for human nutrition, you could meet the basic protein requirements of 500 million people. That's a lot of protein.
In his office, Rathore lays out normal cotton seeds as well as some he's modified.
The gossypol levels have gone down.
You can tell they're just so much whiter. They don't have those little black flecks.
As for what they taste like, these raw seeds are a bit like chickpeas.
It has a pretty mild taste. They're very They kind of stick to your teeth a little bit.
Yeah.
Rathor uses a technique called gene silencing, which mostly mutes a gene that helps produce the toxin in the seed. On a large scale, this could be a new moneymaker for cotton growers who have watched U.S. cotton demand drop for 20 years.
The cotton industry has always been incredibly excited about the potential of getting rid of gossypol.
That's Tom Wiedegartner, a now retired research and marketing director for Cotton Incorporated, an industry group which financed Rathor's research.
Everybody's like, it's a no-brainer. It's just a no-brainer. I mean, why in the world wouldn't we be growing cotton with a more valuable and an edible seed that's in it?
The gossypol level in most cotton seed is about 10,000 parts per million. Rathor's goal was to get it down to 450, which the Food and Drug Administration says is a safe level for human consumption. He got there, but some cotton scientists say it would be hard to maintain that level in commercial cotton. Mike Dowd is a former USDA research scientist who specialized in measuring gossypol. Around 2018, he measured the levels in seeds Rathor was testing.
And so the samples come to me. I think there were 20 or 25 samples from individual plants, and every one of them came out 10 times higher than what Curdy says they are.
Different kinds of cotton naturally have different levels of gossypol. The weather can also affect how much of the toxin is in the plant. But food products, even for livestock feed, have to be consistent, Dowd says.
Man, Lord help you if you say this stuff is 100 to 150 and you give it to a food company and they come out and decide that it's 1,000. That kills it. It's done.
Rathor, the Texas A&M researcher, and Cotton Incorporated have tried to give it to a food company. Lots of them. For years, they met with major seed distributors like Bayer. But large parts of the globe won't take any genetically modified foods. And in countries that would accept them, the seeds would undergo a long, expensive regulatory review. According to Wiedegartner, the companies can't see how they would profit.
It was hard for them to justify all the millions of dollars that they would have to invest.
Now Rathor is trying a new strategy, giving the seeds to developing countries with no strings attached.
My hope is that once they see the benefit, once they see that, yes, farmers are growing it and they're benefiting from it, I think we should do the same thing here in the U.S.
The first country is lined up. Officials in Uzbekistan are ready to start growing Rathor's seeds as soon as possible.
That was Harvest Public Media's Michael Marks reporting on a long-running effort to make cotton seeds safe to eat and the potential benefits for farmers and for global nutrition. This is Main Street on Prairie Public.
The Alzheimer's Association Minnesota, North Dakota, with funding granted through the North Dakota Department of Health and Human Services Aging Services Section, is offering the Dementia Care Services Program. With classes offered at many locations in Minnesota and North Dakota, this month learn healthy living, building foundations of caregiving, and how to utilize the 24/7 helpline available in more than 200 languages. Learn more about the Dementia Care Services Program at alz.org/MNND.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we're spotlighting North Dakota's gateway to science, where curiosity comes alive. Once again with us is Emily Montgomery. She's a STEM educator. Emily, thanks for joining us. Welcome back to Main Street.
Yes, thank you, Craig, for having me.
Some content focus, some ideas to exchange here. North Dakota's winter is here, and you're going to help us embrace it.
Mm-hmm. I know that winter is coming, and it's not coming, it's here. We have been busy with it, but the fun part about science, Craig, is that it's not only just cold out there, but you can bring that cold and STEM and bring them, merge them together, and it's pretty incredible. So I have some fun, different, engaging ideas for what we can do with the white stuff outside, and we can have some fun in some sub-zero temps. So our first one that we have is boiling water and throwing it into the air. You do need some very cold wind chill in order to do this certain experiment, but you can boil some water, and then if the kiddos especially are younger, having a guardian help with that, having that boiling water, throwing it into the air, that water will automatically freeze. So you get to see something really cool that happens when you throw that boiling water up, because you're taking something very hot to a very, very cold environment. We're in North Dakota, so we don't ever have to worry about when that will be, because we're in that cold season already. So taking that, you'll see something really cool happen. It turns into that frozen fog. So it's very cool. We also have another experiment where it's not as hot temperature that you have to work with. My favorite is blowing frozen bubbles. So this also needs to be more in the negatives, having a frozen wind chill happening. But when you take bubbles outside and you blow those bubbles,
just normal bubbles that we would blow in the summertime. Normal bubbles.
Yep, the ones you blow in the summer.
Never thought
about
doing
winter.
That.
Yeah, these are a winter activity too. You can go outside, but instead of worrying about them popping, what happens is the cold air will freeze that bubble. So then you can actually hold that bubble in the air. So it's pretty cool. We've done this with our mini camps that we do, which happens when we do not have school for Bismarck Public Schools. We provide mini camp opportunities. So we did this activity last winter, and it was very fun because we did not tell them what we were doing. And we had them all put on their coats, of course, and we went out to our beautiful deck out here, and we had them all blow bubbles and just said, watch what happens and let's see. And just seeing them being able to hold their bubble, because usually you just see it pop and nothing happens, but talking about how all the molecules are frozen and what occurs there is very, very fun to do. So I highly recommend, and almost everyone has bubbles in their house. It's a very great idea.
What can we do with frozen balloons?
Oh, the frozen balloon. So if you freeze a balloon, the different layers within that balloon, you will pop it, or you fill it with water first, and then you're going to pop the balloon and there will be frozen water underneath. And you can actually do different layers of the balloons as well with that. And just seeing what happens with, because you have frozen water in there, how that will look and just the different layers of freezing within that. So that one's a very fun one as well.
Do you change your access, Emily, during winter break for parents and kids that won't have school for a couple of weeks? Will there be more things to do at the North Dakota Gateway to Science?
Absolutely. So with that, we have mini camps, as I said before, where we do a lot of fun things besides the bubbles as well. Whenever there's not school, we follow the Bismarck Public School schedule. So we have full day mini camps where parents can come. We have some coming up on December 30th and 31st, actually. And those are full day camps. You can find that information on our website to register. There's a members discount as well if you're already a member at North Dakota's Gateway to Science. So be sure to check that out because it's a great, just immersive experience that brings first grade through fifth grade, those age levels, science on their level. And it is a lot of fun and a lot of engagement to science.
That's Emily Montgomery. She's a STEM educator with North Dakota's Gateway to Science, a group that joins us most Thursdays here on Main Street. Emily, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you. Happy to be here.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/Dakota Plans.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and today we're listening to the voices of people who grew up with the force of nature that's become almost mythic in the American West, the Santa Ana winds. For some, they signaled stillness, butterflies, and childhood wonder. For others, they carried dread, a restless, electric feeling in the air that could turn dangerous when fire followed. In this audio collage, residents described the winds that just don't blow around you, but seem to blow through you.
Before they start, like the day before they start, the whole world is still. And when I was little, I noticed that those still days were days that the butterflies wouldn't all come out.
And there were always monarchs, so there was bright orange wings against the blue sky.
So I started calling them butterfly days.
And I remember sitting there when I was a kid blowing bubbles. Because the air was so still, the bubbles wouldn't move. They'd just kind of float there like they were frozen in time.
It was kind of still and quiet. It was like the earth was waiting to take a breath.
That was earthquake weather, when the air feels thick and heavy. It feels like if something doesn't happen, that the earth would start vibrating.
They feel like the phrase, something wicked this way comes.
And everyone feels it. And it's like they know something's coming.
There's something dry about them.
Not much rainfall happening in drought years, if any.
It's hard to explain the drought to people unless they lived in it.
Everything's dead. If it's not dead, it's honestly surprising.
I live in a city now. I always have water. I don't have to think about where it comes from. The grass is green. But when the Santa Ana winds kick up, there is a physical confrontation with dryness and drought that is unusual and troubling.
They don't blow around you, they blow through you. If that makes any sense. And they think that's why they feel different.
I don't know, when I was a little kid, I thought that they were scary.
It just seemed like it was that restless unhappiness that you see or you feel in haunted houses.
It always just felt like the veil between the worlds was thinner when the winds were there.
Oh, I have this very clear sense memory of these tall birch trees that were outside my childhood bedroom. And when the Santa Ana wind came, it would run through the leaves and it would sound like skittering, like insects almost, like a dry skittering across the ground.
It's looking for something, it's seeking something and not quite sure what it is.
That hollow, kind of sick feeling.
Like there were ghosts in the air.
Like a lost spirit, you're right.
Yeah.
And then they came. It was kind of like this screaming.
It was like impossible to go outside after 1 p.m. because the winds were so strong.
They blew so hard. I think I was a toddler and remembering it was hard to stay up.
It's like it wasn't air anymore. It had left its elemental state of air and turned into something bigger and stronger and different and scary.
Physical. It was a solid feeling.
They're very strong. They can uproot trees and you lose a lot of branches and parts of the tops of your house.
Can't talk about Santa Ana winds without talking about everything that it lifts from the earth into the air.
When I was little, I thought they were wonderful because I thought I could fly.
I think we all used to think that when we were younger, that we could just fly away with the wind.
I tried taking an umbrella and having the umbrella lift me up like in Mary Poppins. But that didn't work. I tried putting on this cape thing that I used to have and go really fast and wave my arms, but that didn't work.
When the Santa Ana winds blew in, it was like the normal rules of the world didn't apply anymore.
The Santa Ana winds were always kind of devastating.
I've heard them called devil winds.
It's just like it seems to spark fire.
Like there's something quite hellish about them.
The whole sky was orange. The sun was looking so crazy.
When the Santa Ana winds are paired with fire, which is more and more frequent, it becomes impossible to put out the fire.
It feeds the fire by oxygenating it. It blows up like ashes and embers.
There's ash in the air, and the ash falls like snow.
Ash falling from the sky is not a very uncommon thing here. Nobody's really fazed by it anymore.
You can drive through and see the scars that the fire has left. You know, the land is all blackened, and there's just skeletons of trees, and they're all charred. But now, because of, you know, the drought, we don't really have a fire season anymore, because the fire season is constant, you know, and we don't really have the, you know, Santa Ana wind season.
I seem to remember in our childhood, they would come once or twice a year. And now I feel like we're getting these kinds of winds once every 3 months or so.
There's a loss of that, you know, cycles that we always could count on.
Dryness turning into something that physical instead of something that can be ignored, especially for people who live in cities, that can be really startling. And maybe that's a good thing, because it reminds us that, you know, moisture is not a given.
It's almost like the earth is trying very hard to get our attention.
There's something not of this world attached to the Santa Ana winds, and I don't think it's an inherently positive thing.
So who knows? Maybe the spirits of our ancestors are, you know, in the wind, and they're trying to communicate with us. I think what they're trying to say is, pay attention.
I remember walking across charred, burnt hills, and it makes this sound when you walk through it, this lightest little as you're breaking through the crust of charcoal, and everything is silent.
Those were memories and reflections from people shaped by the Santa Ana winds, winds that have become stronger, drier, and more frequent as the climate changes. Their stories remind us that nature still has ways of getting our attention. This story was brought to us by Rebecca Nolan, a radio documentarian and sound designer living on the windswept island of Newfoundland. You can find more of Rebecca's work at Windswept Radio.
This is Bird Note. Yellow-eyed juncos can be found shuffling through leaf litter in the southeast corner of Arizona and central Mexico, searching for tasty seeds from pines and oaks. And although these fire-eyed birds stay within the same general area year-round, they sometimes make a migration of sorts, not from north to south, but from the high mountains to the lowlands, or the other way around. It's called altitudinal migration. In the warm summer months, some yellow-eyed juncos prefer to nest at higher elevations, where their nests on the ground are less vulnerable to predators. But as winter approaches, the scarcity of food in the snowy peaks often pushes the juncos back down to the desert floor. This altitudinal migration is common for many bird species that live along mountain slopes. Another intriguing migrant, the American dipper, catches its meals by diving into the frigid streams of mountain ranges in the northwest. In colder seasons, when their watery cafeterias freeze solid, dippers migrate downslope and downstream, where flowing water continues to provide a bounty of tasty morsels. To learn more about the many quirky ways birds migrate, start at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Rimmel.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 11th. The Pure Foods Movement was a grassroots effort that called attention to the presence of unhealthy additives in processed food. Prior to 1906, there was no governmental oversight of processed foods and pharmaceutical drugs. Purity, quality, and sanitation were not regulated. Upton Sinclair's 1906 novel, The Jungle, exposed the unsanitary conditions of Chicago slaughterhouses. The book increased people's awareness of the unhealthy condition of some foods. There are many examples of producers trying to maximize their profit by adulterating their products. Milk, for example, was often thinned with water. Dyes, chalk, or plaster dust were then added to enhance the color. In the days before refrigeration, a common additive to milk was formaldehyde as a preservative. One early champion of pure food and drugs was Professor Edwin F. Ladd, the chemistry instructor at the North Dakota Agricultural College. Professor Ladd was concerned that people were being poisoned by chalk dust, coal tar, toxic dyes, and other additives. One of Professor Ladd's targets was ketchup. Benzoate of soda was being added to ketchup. Producers claimed it was necessary to preserve ketchup after the bottle was opened. Ladd pointed out that producers of ketchup were known to add water to increase the volume of ketchup at very little cost. Ladd said that after a bottle of ketchup was opened, it increased the rate of spoilage. If the producers didn't add water, they would not need to add the benzoate of soda. A good reason to avoid the additive is that it can turn into benzene, a carcinogen, when mixed with vitamin C, which is plentiful in ketchup. Eventually, the use of clean factories allowed ketchup to be made from ripe tomatoes instead of fermented tomatoes, eliminating the need for benzoate of soda. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
It's Michelle Martin. Every weekday morning, my Morning Edition co-host and I have some questions.
What do you say to that concern from voters that there needs
Can this squarely be laid on the feet of the government shutdown, or are there deeper problems?
Do you agree it's important for government officials to be truthful before Congress?
Get information, context, accountability on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition, weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. Central on Prairie Public.
Hi, I'm Mary Louise Kelly. We are at an inflection point when it comes to journalism, a fork in the road, if you will. We could head down the path to where only a few agenda-driven companies control the flow of information. Or we could energize the reliable sources for fact-driven, unbiased, uninfluenced news. One of those dependable sources is public radio. While trusted publications often require a paid subscription, public radio's over-the-air and digitally on-demand service is free for everyone. We rely on voluntary donations from our listeners to share in the costs. In North Dakota, public radio means Prairie Public. So please support the excellent regional coverage and the global and national reporting here at NPR. Just go to prairiepublic.org and open the donate tab.
And that wraps up this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at prairiepublic.org or wherever you grab your favorite podcasts. At 8 p.m. tonight, following the rebroadcast of Main Street, it's The Middle, live with Jeremy Hobson. The question this week, Does Going Green Matter to You? And that episode will be replayed tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, and at 7 p.m. Central on Friday, it's Ira Flatow and Science Friday. From all of us here at Prairie Public, we hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we'll see you again Monday, right back here on Main Street.